Timeline America. I'm Frank Spring, and with me is Ellie Jacobs, an internationally respected authority on when it is and is not clobbering time.
By my view, it's basically always clobbering time.
Damn, Frank, right.
As always, it's good to join you. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for their comments, both positive and negative, and urge everybody to subscribe and rate us on iTunes and follow us on Twitter at Taking Ship, and that's ship with a P as in persnickety. Those ratings and the subscription numbers really matter, particularly as our quest to get mattress money continues, so please be sure to do that. In addition to the Twitters, you can check out our website, takingship.com, where you can order your t-shirts. We got rave reviews for them at TrueCon, and for those of you who are awaiting delivery, I put them in the mail yesterday, so you should hopefully get them by the end of the week, unless Donald Trump does something really dumb. All right, so Frank, what are we talking about today?
So this week we've got a couple of things. We're going to talk about the primaries here in a little bit. Yesterday was a big primary day, but before that, this being Dumbest Timeline America, we really do have an awesome entry in the dumbest goddamn thing that has happened in national affairs in quite some time.
Can I just comment? We didn't record last week because of the Truman Conference, but the last 2 weeks really have given Dumbest Timeline America a run for its money.
Yeah, we're soaring to heights unimagined in just how completely fucking stupid we can get.
And it's like a Farley Brothers movie of a farce at this point.
Yeah, we have just like, honestly, yeah, this is the low budget Bulgarian sequel to the Airplane trilogy. So all right, here we've got a continuation of an old story, but a good story. The NFL continues to botch the anthem protests. They've already made a sad and sorry mess of it. And then yesterday, so the quick catch up, NFL owners passed a rule requiring that NFL players either stand for the anthem or stay in the locker room. This pleased nobody. It was a completely dumb idea. The NFL...
And not done in conjunction with the players' union.
And not done in conjunction with the NFL Players Association, who took Roger Goodell's word that there wasn't going to be a rule passed. I'm beginning to suspect the executive director of the NFLPA, DeMora Smith, may only just now be realizing that that man wasn't really an actual accredited wallet inspector at all. So anyway, that happened, but you should read David Roth and Deadspin on this. Trump will never be... This was done to placate Donald Trump. Trump will never be satisfied. He will continue to come after the NFL owners, and because they can never give him enough, that he sees this as a winning issue and grievance is his currency. And so it has proven to be. Donald Trump, feeling a little hurt that not enough of the Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles were going to visit the White House, and their scheduled visit canceled it, and instead on Wednesday rescinded the invitation and instead had an event celebrating patriotism in which he botched the lyrics to God Bless America in front of a large crowd of what appeared to be White House interns. I wish I was making this up. Now, because this involves the Philadelphia Eagles, we are joined by our special Eagles correspondent, Mike Connolly. Mike Connolly is a communications director by trade. He is a political operative. He is a member of the Truman National Security Project. He is a native son of South Philadelphia, their most important historical political figure. Don't at me. I warn you, he is from Philadelphia, so anything he says, any of the takes that emerge from his mouth are his and his alone. He speaks for no one in this capacity on this podcast. But he is our official Eagles correspondent to help us sort out the dumbest possible mess in the dumbest possible timeline. Welcome, Mike Connolly.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Mike, what are we to make of this? God damn it. How are we to feel? What can you say? What can we possibly say?
I mean, it really is the most fertile possible time for scorching hot takes. So there's a lot that could be made of it. I think probably the most interesting aspect of it is just how unbelievably idiotic Trump is. You two, by trade, would have a great handle on this, but there's no path whatsoever for him to win re-election without Pennsylvania again. And so he just gave a giant middle finger to, and I say this with deep affection for this attribute, the pettiest city in America by far. So all anybody running in 2020, unless we nominate some weird corporate overlord like Howard Schultz, all they have to do is just run ads and go, he doesn't respect you, I do. Remember when he canceled on the Eagles, and then he's just going to get 110% of the vote out of Philly.
Is the Eagles, and that's something a human being would say. Is the Eagles that big a deal in the and is this perhaps more likely? Will this buy him any points with Pittsburgh Steelers fans?
It won't, because they Steelers fans are also deeply tribal about their team. So any attack on the NFL doesn't play really well with them. But Philly is a weird city in that other teams are identified with the city and the city with that team a little bit. But in Philly, it is the religion. It's the Eagles are to Philly what God is to the Vatican. Only the Eagles are real. So that's the level of attachment. And I would describe it as if there was a nuclear blast and you were telling somebody about that in Philly and you said, you know, there was a nuclear explosion in another neighborhood. The Eagles won today, and that you've got milliseconds to live before that explosion hits you. They'd go, wait, so the Eagles won? Like, that's all they care about.
What you're describing is a city full of maniacs.
Yes.
Well, honestly, that pretty well checks out.
Let's bear in mind, this is the same city that had its police force grease lampposts with Crisco.
As if that would be enough.
Although I'll tell you what, they missed the opportunity to chop him down and fry him up, because I don't know what that would have been like, but there's probably something there. Get on it, Philadelphia. They're probably still greasy enough as it is. Is there anything that Trump could do to unfuck this, leaving aside the hilarity of the image of this guy attempting to sing God Bless America, backed up by the Marine Corps chorus and the band, in front of a crowd of what had to be White House and RNC interns and no Eagles fans? Leaving that aside, is there anything he could do to win them back? Like, should he throw batteries at a child? Like, what? Like, is this thing just beyond recall?
I mean, obviously, the battery idea is a good one, and a good move that he'll probably do. But he really is.
Do they throw batteries at people in Philadelphia weddings? Like, instead of like rice, they just like hurl, hurl D batteries at the bride and groom.
Absolutely. And my favorite thing from the Eagles parade by far after we won the Super Bowl, which you may have heard, was these buses going up Broad Street of all these players and people just whipping unopened beer cans up at them. And every Eagles player, like they're in the Matrix, picking bullets out of the air, just snatching these things and just slamming them right away. That's the city Philly is. They're never, ever going to forget the slightest insult from Donald Trump. So there's nothing that can be done. And it's sad, because Donald Trump is so great at what he does. He is the Chris Kyle of tweeting weird shit with chicken grease on his hands. And he's a petty media grievance monster. And so that should already line up with what Philly's belief system is. But they'll never be on the same side from here on out, no matter what.
That's an excellent point. If there's any city that should have understood mindless recalcitrant defiance, and it should be that should be the place that Donald Trump that's Donald Trump's happy hunting ground. Yet here we are.
This is a city that keeps a bell with a crack in it for spite to show off shoddy workmanship.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh man, that's amazing. All right, so there's nothing he can really do about it. What is oh my god, and it also that description of the parade is awesome. It sounds like you basically live in Mad Max Fury Road, which I have to say is awesome as shit. So let's talk a little bit about the NFL in this thing, because we've got a minute longer before we lose you here. So leaving aside the Philadelphia aspect, I want your opinion on this as a communications guy and a political guy. Is there any way that the NFL owners could have fucked this up worse than they have by making this particular rule in this way?
No, I don't know how they possibly could have.
I disagree. I say that there's one thing that they could have done. They could have just specified African-American players rather than all players.
Well, I'm sure that'll be the compromise from this that they go to try to appease all sides.
Wait, guys, we've got a better idea. I'm sorry. Oh my God.
Hold my beer, as the kids say.
Yeah. If that weren't so entirely possible. Oh boy. Oh boy.
This isn't my most original take. I think other people have said this too, but this is tremendous, because everybody hates replays in football. They take forever. And so now, if there's an actual penalty associated with taking a knee, what if somebody ties their shoes for a moment or leans towards the ground? Do we have to have instant replays about whether their knee touched the ground or not? I mean, because this is actual 15 yards in the game.
Yeah. Was this person making a protest move? Did he carry his protest all the way to the ground? Yeah, no, this is, I hadn't really thought about that, but this is so ripe for the kind of over adjudication that the leadership of the NFL seems to think that's what, like, basically what they seem to think we're here for is an appellate court. Like, we are, what we're looking for is an appellate court that periodically stops for an outbreak of unbelievable violence, but mainly we're there for the reasoning and the argument.
Yeah, and it's a classic NFL and just corporate move in general to figure, hey, we have to find some middle ground between these things rather than just picking a side, taking your medicine for pissing off some of the other side. And if they had just said, hey, we're not going to limit speech in any way, and then gone even more over the top, which they're already at like a 9.5 for their constant worship of the troops in every possible game and having, you know, flyovers and troops on the field and troops. The only thing that they could do additionally is make the players troops. Like, that should be rule change.
That is so brilliant. Just send an officer down to do a swearing in ceremony, like have a few members of Congress there. I mean, let's really make a goddamn farce of this thing. By the way, folks, just for those of you, I didn't mention in his bio, and I should have, I forgot about this. Mike himself is a veteran and one of America's great troop respecters.
Yeah, I'm a great troop respecter. I was one of the troops. And I just think, like, no matter what, Nick Foles beat Tom Brady terribly. Tom Brady was awful in that Super Bowl game.
It was embarrassing in that game that they played, which was the Super Bowl.
Yes, but like right before handing that MVP award to Nick Foles, they should have just at least ceremoniously given it to the troops, because we can never do enough for our
brothers. That's true. The most valuable players were the people who made
the troops. The troops. Chris Kyle is always the most valuable player in any game.
Perennially, the Chris Kyle award for Chris Kyle is forever given to Chris Kyle. Yeah, that's exactly right. But also,
what I find interesting is, like, most of the states where there's the mindless Trump worship, you know, the true red hats, are all states that don't have NFL teams.
Yeah, and that should be the other thing, is like every single state, just like how we cling to this moronic system where every state, regardless of population, has two senators. If we're going to do that, every state should have their own NFL team. It's only fair. We should have the Wyoming random dog catchers and street magicians and people who would make that football team, and we should just watch them get massacred by the Philadelphia Eagles, as everybody else has suffered the same fate recently.
I like where you're going with that. I think I think that would make the NFL a lot more like college football, which has its own problems, but is wonderfully anarchic and batshit enough to keep us all entertained. Also, I want to amend that idea by suggesting that that Nick Foles should not, when he received the MVP, should also have received a commission and a promotion and a field promotion on the spot. Like, congratulations, you're now a colonel. You're now a colonel. Here's your battalion.
Just be a troop. Yeah.
Just be a troop. Yeah, exactly.
Let's just get it over with.
Yeah. I think it's got potential. All right, Mike, thank you. I wish we could keep you on here for longer. We want to bring you back to talk some more politics later, but I know we only have you for a short visit. Is there anything else on the subject of Donald Trump, the Eagles, or the NFL, or Philadelphia, that wonderful Mad Max film that you all have going on up there that we should know about?
No, I just think everybody focuses on the negative. They always do that on like this NFL saga, but it's been great for art. It gave us the hit song, Take a Knee, My Ass. I Won't Take a Knee.
Yes, yes, so that's true. We didn't talk about this on that podcast, and we owe our listeners an apology.
Yeah, and then we got this Jacob Wall tweet from yesterday where he declares that the national anthem is his favorite song, which it's mine. It's a party hit. I love the bass line on it, so... It's been great for art. It's been great for creativity.
That is so true, and I'm glad someone's finally having the courage to say it.
Finally, I'm not afraid to get too controversial on your show, but I'll stand up for the national anthem as a song. I think it's okay. It's got legs.
That's a strong take, and I'm bound to respect it, Mike. Mike, thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
All right. See you guys.
Mike. I mean, Frank, as a general rule, we're pretty big on any drinking song that gets reappropriated as a national anthem.
Yeah, that's entirely where we're at. But that's that honestly, like, those are the best national anthems. The other ones are stentorian and a little bit self-serious.
Touchy-feely, yeah.
Yeah, touchy-feely, yeah.
Exactly. Before we switch to the primaries, I do have one question, and this has kind of been bothering me, as I don't watch a lot of sports anymore, aside from Notre Dame football, when games don't coincide with my 25 hours of Sabbath rest. So I've been watching the semifinals and then the finals. I love watching when things are on the line. So overtime Stanley Cup finals hockey is like the best thing in the world. The question I've kind of just been thinking about is, A, what if we just stopped singing the song before every game and just did it like at the Super Bowl or something like that? And B, I know that there were a few players in professional baseball who took a knee during the anthem, but why hasn't that spread to other sports? You'd think that particularly after the NFL's rule change, there would be a larger move of players supporting other players.
That's a really good question. And the anthem, there actually is history of the anthem. It has not always been done. It's actually a fairly recent development. Of singing the anthem at sporting events. There's no reason particularly to do it. No other country does this that I know of in their major leagues. It's ridiculous. Why it hasn't spread farther and why there wasn't more of a response when it was done in other leagues, because you're right, I think there were a couple of baseball players that did it, I think is really interesting. Partly didn't develop there, but didn't start there. So it was sort of like that wasn't seen as being the epicenter of the problem. The NBA has had visible protests. The NBA, which is often seen as the kind of the woke NFL, I guess, because the owners tend to be a little less publicly bilious. The leadership is a little less nakedly authoritarian, and some of their head coaches say fairly liberal things from time to time. I'm thinking of Steve Kerr and Greg Popovich being the big ones. The NBA is kind
honestly,
of
if we're not running them for some kind of office in the next 10 years, we're doing everything.
They're both extremely articulate people, but the NBA actually has an anthem rule. I mean, that's why you didn't see it in the NBA. Players are able to make protests in other ways, but they actually have an anthem rule. You have to go out, you have to stand.
Yeah, there were a lot of the piece. I think there were T-shirts that were worn after the Trayvon Martin killing.
That's right. I think it was the Gardner one, and LeBron James and a few other folks wore the shirt that said "I can't breathe," which is which at the time was as Black Lives Matter was coming together, was messaging that was very much associated with that. Why there hasn't been more in other sports, I think, is an interesting question. Why there wasn't more backlash against baseball? I think part of it, and this would be a really good question for David Roth. Whose piece on the NFL that he put up yesterday, you really have to read it.
We don't say that big things are a must read often, but
yeah, this
piece just for the prose alone is a must read, let alone the ideas that he's pushing.
But I think part of it is, and we talked about this in our interview with him, the NFL weaponizes nostalgia in a dangerous and poisonous way, in a way that no other league does.
Which is awesome because of the irony that none of the players will remember yesterday.
That is so true. That is absolutely so true. And it's the sort of thing that we should be talking about more. And I mean that both in a kind of like, oh God, that's awful, ironic sense, and in a yes, quite so. Sense they weaponize nostalgia in a poisonous way, and part of the NFL shtick for I think a certain portion of its fan base, the people that Trump is talking to certainly, is this kind of fantasy of being able to tell these almost superhumanly athletic Black dudes what to do. The performance of authority is much greater in football than it is in anything else. I mean, you don't get it in baseball. You don't really get it. Certainly don't get it in basketball. Basketball right now has sort of one head coach who is kind of a system coach that people know by name and who is kind of the face of his franchise right now. It's Greg Popovich. You know, Steve Kerr is a very good coach, but he's not the face of that franchise. He's not even probably third or fourth on that list. You know, there are people out there who probably can't name the head coach of the Cleveland Cavaliers. And honestly, why should they? Who coach? I mean, the person who's coaching LeBron James is kind of neither here nor there. You know, that is LeBron's team. And that sport in particular, and this is also, I think, true for baseball, the players are the bigger person, are a much bigger part of, the branding and the public persona of the sport. And those players tend overwhelmingly to be people of color. The image of white authority over folks of color is just not baked into them in the way that it is in the NFL. And I think that's probably why this hasn't developed as a flashpoint.
It's an interesting idea that in football, where set plays are, the rule, because you're setting up for every single play, even in no huddle, you're still setting up for a play that has been called previously, whereas every other sport, it's extemporaneous to a much different degree.
That's right. And the
authority aspect is interesting. And we've talked about this before. And again, I use this word very reluctantly, but there is an aspect of folks throughout the country who appreciate putting people in their place, particularly if they are people of a minority.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And one of the joys of football, actually, one of the things that I really enjoy about it, is that it is this conflict between the game. One of the game's tensions is between preparation and spontaneity, like the building of a system and the breaking down of a system. I mean, if you sort of think about it, there is more preparation going into an NFL playoff game, actually an NFL regular season game, you know, with the, in terms of if you take the proportion of people off the field preparing for something to happen and people on the field making that thing happen, the proportion of preparation to execution is about, I mean, you're looking at more, you're looking at a higher ratio of preparation to execution than any human endeavor since the Third Army invaded Iraq. It is a massively prepared operation, and yet the system breaks all the time.
Yeah.
Because these people are so good at what they do and so remarkable, such remarkable specimens, you know, athletically and then within the and also in a sort of in a human sense in terms of, you know, focus and concentration and improvisation, all of these things. They're these geniuses at their specific thing. There's no amount of planning you can do that will prep for Odell Beckham. You know, there's no amount of planning that you can do that will prep someone for Adrian Peterson at his best. Like, you plan until you're blue in the face. And then, I mean, this has been true of Adrian Peterson for years, but you plan until you're blue in the face. And then one of these people does something amazing and all of this system just breaks.
Yeah. Like the first few before Mike Vick got into trouble, he was, it's a perfect example of somebody that just blew up on everybody's system. So, you know, Mike Vick kind of turned everything on its head and the NFL is still playing catch up with some of these new players who are coming in and some of the new athletics. And that's why you see some systems in college that don't work in the NFL. But speaking of systems that are sort of seemingly working, let's turn to the primaries from yesterday.
Sure. Before we do that, actually, I do want to push back on you a little bit, which is to say the idea that the systems in college don't work in the NFL is actually a function of what we're talking about. The teams that work in the NFL are the ones that are adapting college systems.
Oh, yeah, that's actually a good point.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, now let's talk some politics. Hello and welcome to Taking Ship, your sort of rambling pro versus college football blog.
Yeah, we just continue podcast. To have the stupidest football conversations possible.
Yeah, I wonder. Yeah, there's probably a lesson to be learned in that, but I categorically refuse to accept the possibility.
It's just David Roth just leads us down this path that you can talk about both intelligently.
Mm-hmm. I know, and it's you know, he can, Spencer Hall can. The whole crew of Shutdown Fullcast can. There's like seven or eight people. Holly Anderson can also on Shutdown Fullcast now. Yeah, there's like seven or eight people who can do this, and we're not either one of us one of them.
Yeah, Greg Popp and Steve Kerr.
Yeah, sure. All right, politics, primary fever, catch it and then die of it. We had primaries yesterday across a large number of states, and the news was largely good, actually, for the Democratic Party. Ellie, what do you think?
I agree. I think it was a good day all over. You know, I kind of have three big takeaways, and these shouldn't sound particularly revolutionary to anybody who's been paying attention. The first is that women continue to do extraordinarily well in the primaries, particularly Democratic women, although a number of Republican women did very well yesterday as well. Another important takeaway is that this is 100% Trump's GOP, and folks are either living or dying by him. For better or worse, probably for worse. The third big takeaway is that particularly with Dianne Feinstein winning in California and then several other primaries where the sort of the Bernie-esque person not only lost but got toasted, kind of gives a really good perspective that Bernie's revolution continues to die and continues to die at really a startling clip compared to where it was a year ago.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with that. I think the candidates that are put up from that wing of the party continue largely to struggle, but you find the positions that Bernie and positions that are associated with the left of the party are actually just entering the mainstream, and I think that's partly why. Now, Feinstein is
absolutely.
But if you look at, we'll talk a little bit about my glorious home state of New Mexico. But if you look at the candidates who were the leaders to win. The New Mexico Congressional District 1, which is the Albuquerque area, Bernalillo County, and the East Mountains, the most populous part of New Mexico by a good chalk. All of the leaders, two of them were openly for what is now being called Medicare for All, and the third was, I think, for a public option. He was a little more conservative on it. But again, these are positions that 12 years ago would have been... 12 years ago, his position probably would have been out of step with the Democratic mainstream. Now he was considered the more conservative one. So a lot of, and this accounts for, I think, why some of these candidates are struggling, actually. Candidates from the far left is the center is actually co-opting, the so-called center is actually pretty left now and is taking a fair number of their positions.
Yeah, that's for sure. And then, you know, you have the other states, you know, the Senate race that I'm going to continue to keep my eye on, not just because I have my pretend house in Montana, is the tester seat. I think it really, more so than Manchin Heitkamp or the gentle lady from Missouri, I think Montana is really going to be a sinker, going to demonstrate where quote-unquote red state America is, because Montana is just interesting in general that there have generally been Democratic senators and a Democratic governor, yet they voted for Donald Trump by something like 35 points or something like that.
Yeah, no, it's a strange state from that perspective. And Tester is one of those people that on paper really should be deeply, deeply worried about his seat, and I know he's certainly not taking it for granted. You know, I would just honestly... The smart money, in my view, is never against John Tester, but there's just something.
There's a reason Ryan Zinke. Yeah, there's a reason Ryan Zinke didn't take his flag and go back home to run against him.
Yes, that's an excellent point. I mean, partly because he's able to, you know, I mean, he's able to swan around and he's got a pretty good gig, is right now a gig that he has made even better for himself if you count ridiculous accoutrements. But you're right. I mean, Tester is. There really just hasn't been a pathway forward for Republicans while Tester's been in that seat. And you know, I mean, I know they have their eyes are big and excited now, but you know, the smart money is never against John Tester, as I said.
And there's a reason that he's on the Veterans Affairs Committee. I think the stat I saw was a 1 in 3 people from Montana either served or had an immediate family member that served in the military.
Yeah.
So, you know, just astounding number, particularly for, you know, those of us that are stuck on the East Coast.
Yeah, it's a huge number. It's a huge number. So that seat is an interesting one. Another one that's worth watching, just to keep an eye on, is New Jersey. Bob Menendez, again, the Democratic candidate, shouldn't really be a thing, except that he's been dogged by ethics complaints, one of which ended in a criminal prosecution. Is your sense? I don't really actually have that much of a sense of New Jersey politics. Do you have a sense that this is going to be an issue? That this is something that Democrats should be worried about?
It's hard to say right now. New Jersey is an interesting state just because it's still very, very much a machine politics state. And Menendez came through the ranks through the House. And then when Torricelli resigned, or when Lautenberg died, one of those things, because New Jersey is insane that way. And the track record of senators is not great lately. Menendez was appointed to the seat, then he won election towards his own right. He has never been a clean politician, as most in New Jersey are not either. The stuff that he was caught up with sounded really bad, and that's why I went to trial. He was exonerated by the jury and then took back his minority chairmanship of the Foreign Affairs Committee. I don't know if he should really be worried about it. I don't know that anybody expected that to the result yesterday. Basically, what happened yesterday is that a no-name candidate who basically ran no ads only ended up losing by like 25 points, which you would have thought that Menendez would have gotten 80-90% of the primary vote. The Republicans are running a very serious Trump accolade as the opponent, Hagan. He's got a lot of money and a lot of resources of his own right. I think that now, whereas the GOP may not have been looking at New Jersey as a potential pickup, I think right now they've got to be salivating. And I said this at the time, Menendez should have resigned at the time, especially when it went to trial, the fact that he hasn't. And if this hurts the party, I mean, it just demonstrates that politicians who get stuck up in crap, particularly shit that ends up going to trial, just resign. Taking ship rule of thumb.
Exactly. If you've already been prosecuted, generally speaking, it's going to be pretty hard to come back from that. If you've been indicted, it's pretty hard to come back from that. And even if you have the processes, even if you do come back from it, the process is usually so onerous that it's the game isn't worth the candle.
So I think we're going to see New Jersey become contested, and a shit ton of money is going to have to get diverted.
That's a real possibility. Better news.
One last thought on that, Frank, because before we turn to California, because both these states have one significant thing in common. For the Democrats to win the 25-26 seats that they need to win to take over the House, a lot of those seats need to be picked up by red to blue switches in both New Jersey and California. And I think now with the Menendez thing, the question is, how does that impact the downtick of races for the seats that the Democrats are looking to flip in New Jersey?
That's a good point. Democrats got some good candidates, or at least some favorite candidates, and I think they're largely good. some of them very good candidates like Tom Malinowski, won in New Jersey yesterday in Democratic primary. So this is, if you're looking for, you know, for good fits for these kind of purpling red to blue type districts in New Jersey, a lot of the candidates that you would hope for won yesterday. Again, I mentioned Tom Malinowski, Mickey Sherrill's another one that Democrats have been pretty high on. She won in her primary. New Jersey is shaping up congressionally pretty well. So the concern is if these end up being fairly tight races, as they very well might, if the top of the ticket, which would be Menendez, isn't the draw that you would hope, you know, that could be a bit of a liability in tighter down ticket races. So we shall have to see. Turning our attention now to the West Coast, California, which there was a narrative emerging over the last couple of weeks that because of California's jungle primary system, where it's like battle royale in there.
Yeah, Frank, let's take a step back and really explain this one because I myself was confused by it up until a few days ago because I thought I understood it and clearly did not.
It's essentially everyone is allowed to run at the same time. This is basically what it boils down to. If you're running for one of the offices, everyone runs at the same time, and then the top two vote getters, regardless of party, go on to face each other in November. So you can have two Democrats running against each other. You can have two Republicans running against each other. You can have a Republican and a Democrat. You can have in theory, you could have third party candidates, although they tend to get squeezed out by these things. So that's the nature of the jungle primary. Everyone runs at once.
In the most expensive media markets in the country, of the most expensive media markets in the country, you have two Democrats spending money against each other.
Okay? Yeah, it's absolutely bonkers. And not a lot of people really like the system particularly. But it's absolutely hilarious. And it has resulted in, it really is just anarchic and can be quite absurd. But the fear was that it was going to be more than that this time around, that because there are a number of pickup opportunity seats in California, some of them in blueing areas in the Central Valley and the Inland Empire, places that were traditionally Republican that are becoming a little more Democratic, a lot in Southern California and the area around San Diego, which used to be fairly reliably Republican and affluent, is beginning to change, turning blue a little bit. Thinking about Darrell Issa is retiring. His seat has been a pickup opportunity for, this is the second cycle now, number of seats in that area.
A huge result yesterday was Rohrabacher, the Russian apologist and just all around slime ball, only got 30%.
Yeah, exactly. And then he had been a lock for the longest.
He's been camped out in that seat since Methuselah, I think.
Yes, exactly. So there are all of these people. These have been reliably Republican seats, and they've been turning. They've been pickup opportunities. Some of them already. Some of them are emerging as pickup opportunities now. But the fear was there's so many Democrats. There's so much Democratic enthusiasm that you'd have three, four, five qualified. In different degrees, but three, four, five competitive. Maybe all of them qualified Democratic candidates, and the fear is they would. They would take enough share away from each other that you could end up with two Republicans if there were two Republicans running. And Republicans very cleverly did run two Republicans in a lot of the seats. They found someone to challenge their own incumbent in the hopes that they would have an incumbent Republican and then another Republican standard bearer who's basically a sacrificial lamb but who could occupy that spot on the November ballot. And it looked like that was a real possibility for a stretch there in some of these races. That fear seems to have subsided. A lot of those districts are still being counted, but it seems like that has passed. There will be Democrats on the ballot in almost all of the pickup opportunities. When last I checked, and these things are still being counted, so it may have changed since I looked at this before we started this podcast. But when last I checked, I think there was one seat that was considered a bit of a pickup opportunity in the California 10th that might not have a Democrat on it, but it very well might. Most of the other ones, there was going to be a Democrat, and these represent very, very promising pickup opportunities for Democrats.
I think importantly, statewide, the fact that Newsom and Villagrosa are not going to be running against each other in the fall is good for Democrats overall. That means that there's a possibility that a Republican could win, but numbers being what they are, I would say
possibility is a kind word assessing his chances.
Yeah, it's a long bet, but at least you don't have two Democrats just dumping tons and tons and tons of money into the state to beat each other up.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That's an excellent point. I mean, there should be some upward lift from Gavin Newsom. That one of the things that's sort of really interesting about this is that Villaraigosa he was the mayor of Los Angeles for a number of years, was considered at one point a rising star in the party. He's been out of the game for a while, never really took off. I think he finished with 11% of the vote, which is lower than I would have thought, even assuming that Newsom was the overwhelming presumptive favorite. And he goes into the general election now with a huge war chest, with a comparatively weak Republican opponent, and an opportunity to do, if he chooses to, a lot of good up and down the ballot, which is important because Dianne Feinstein is not going to be meaningfully challenged, and she's not going to draw a lot of voters out. So there is one talking point that I would be aware of is you see out there a little bit that the percentage of the electorate that turned up to vote in these to vote in the jungle primaries was more Republican than Democrat. Let's not get confused about what this means. That's fairly typical for California elections. Usually Republicans turn out during the jungle primary in a higher percentage, and the general election percentages tends to be more Democratic. So these are genuine pickup opportunities, especially it's an excellent point if the governor's race drives some turnout. So largely good news for Democrats coming out of California.
Yeah, I have always one image in my mind when you talk about California and turnout, head of state, which was this kind of batshit lunatic Chris Rock ends up running for president as an alderman from Washington, D.C. or something like that. And the end of the movie, you get to the end of the movie and he's running against kind of the establishment, sitting vice president who keeps saying that his cousin's Sharon Stone or something. It's kind of a ridiculous movie that Bernie Mac is also in. But towards the end of it, there's this scene where the news reporter is saying that polls are closing in California and Maze Gillum is the name of Chris Rock's character, is winning. And you just see all the white people in Orange County running towards the streets to go vote. That's just an image that's always stuck in my head when it comes to Orange County and California politics.
And the way that they went. And one of the things that's interesting about California is the extent to which California politics has changed in the last generations. I mean, Republican Governor Pete Wilson in Proposition 187, which was one of the most nakedly racist pieces of referenda to have ever hit the American populace.
Yeah, and let that 187 number just hit you in the head.
That was what it was. That piece of legislation was introduced, I think, in 1994. So this is not that long ago. I mean, this is, was not that long ago that was a state that would elect a kind of Republican who would, for those who may not know, Proposition 187 was a referendum item that went to the California people, basically making it legal and indeed for the state of California to deny certain public services to undocumented immigrants, and expanding their power to demand proof of citizenship from anyone. In some respects, it's a forerunner of a lot of what we've seen now. But it was a remarkably conservative, remarkably racist piece of legislation that was on the docket in a state that is now deep, deep, deep blue. So sometimes things change gradually, and then it's like how the guy went broke gradually and then all at once.
Yeah. All right. So let's move on from California. Let's move down a couple states over to your home state, Frank. Let's get the deep dive on New Mexico.
Sure. Yeah, we're going to spend just a little bit of time here because I think there's a couple of interesting examples from sort of what's happening in politics generally coming from that state. First, the top of the ticket, the gubernatorial race. The Republican candidate is Congressman Steve Pierce from New Mexico Congressional District 2. He is a Republican. He's been there since before the Freedom Caucus, but was very strongly associated with them. Ran unopposed. He's running for governor. On the Democratic side, sitting Congresswoman Michelle Lujan Grisham from Congressional District 1, which again is the Albuquerque and a lot of the surrounding area, as running for governor. She ran against a couple of guys who were not particularly well-known in statewide politics. One of them was a guy named Joe Cervantes. He's a state senator. The other is a guy named Joe Apodaca, son of a governor, not particularly involved in politics until recently. And the reason I bring this up is that in the last couple of days, Michelle Lujan Grisham has been favored all along. In the last couple of days, last week or so, there have been a couple of articles, one in Politico, I think, that may have gotten some pickup elsewhere, that created sort of a scandal around her and the woman, and also a state House representative who serves as the treasurer for a campaign. They have a consulting firm together. The consulting firm has made a fair amount of money consulting with the New Mexico's high-risk insurance pool. New Mexico is one of 9 states to have a high-risk insurance pool. Many states phased them out after Obamacare became a law of the land. And the implication here is, you know, it's a little bit of reading between the lines, but the implication here is, you know, as an elected state senator and a congresswoman kept this thing open because kept this high-risk insurance pool open because they're making money. That is not what happened. Bullshit. But it's the kind of story that could have gotten some traction. And so what we were looking at yesterday was, was Michelle Lujan Grisham going to lose her primary? She was not. The question was she going to experience a dip in the polls? The polls were predicting that she would win 55% and her combined opponents would win about 45%. She finished with 66% of the vote. She absolutely crushed them. And it's a good example of, and Republicans are going to bring up this thing as best they can. Steve Pierce is going to talk about this supposed scandal. There is no scandal here. It's nothing. It's some bad optics, but not really much more than that. These are not people that are feathering their own nests. Does anyone who knows them?
That's what they said about a real estate deal in Arkansas.
That's exactly right. This is a thing though. This is why I'm really glad you brought that up, because this is the thing. For a scandal like this to take root, and again, I guess it's possible that this might take root in the minds of the electorate, but for a scandal like this to take root, it has to resonate with a narrative that already exists a little bit about that candidate that voters are already thinking about. There is, you know, voters have fairly or unfairly, and a lot of this has been unfair, and in the case of Hillary Clinton, very, very gendered, voters have often thought there is something a little bit dishonest about the Clintons. And again, full caveat that this has been promoted with billions of dollars over the course of 2.5 decades, but it's what allows scandals like that to keep going. I doubt if anyone who talked about her emails even really remembered what the scandal was about by the end of that cycle, but it became an avatar for this notion that she was duplicitous and had something to hide. Another good example of this from Swift was John Kerry and the Swift voters. What the Swift boat folks were contending was complete bullshit. But because there was something about Kerry that seemed inauthentic, there was the idea that this guy is pretending to be something that he isn't. The idea that he could be a fake war hero was able to take root in a way that it wouldn't otherwise. What is happening in New Mexico now?
This is a really interesting kind of larger meta issue. One of the conversations that we had over at the Truman Conference over the weekend was this idea that, particularly in the day and age of social media, Republicans are getting even better at the tried and true tactic that they do, where they try to define candidates early. And where they do that is they, particularly with social media now, they just come up with every little piece of insane nonsense and throw it out there. And then what they see sticks, they run with it like nobody's business, which is far more effective than what Democrats do. And you're doing that in a situation where voters overall are tend to view Democratic candidates as weak. So any narrative that the Republicans can add to that, and again, they're testing things just nonstop. We saw this with the Trump campaign also. They are continuously, this is sort of what the Cambridge Analytica thing was about, just continually testing, you know, hundreds of thousands of different messages and ads. But there has to be something there for them to bite into. And that's why when they continue to test things, they see something that works, they run with it because they know.
That's exactly right. That's an excellent point. And this is exactly it. And what they're doing is they're testing. And that's a great word for it. It is possible, and when we say there has to be something there, we don't mean there has to be any factual basis for it. No, perish the fucking
thought. There needs to be.
That needs to resonate with something that the electorate already has or worries about with respect to these candidates. We are going to see that, and this was always going to happen. We're going to see that in New Mexico against Michelle Lujan Grisham as Steve Pierce tries to prevent a historic first in which a woman governor is succeeded by a woman governor for the first time in American history. Outgoing governor is Susana Martinez. Michelle Lujan Grisham would be the incoming governor, and she is, again, favored in this race because New Mexico is blueing and because she is an extremely energetic campaigner against Steve Pierce, who is not, although he does have all the money in the world. But my point is this: it is very hard, almost impossible, to completely manufacture a narrative about someone. If people already have doubts, if there's a resonance with your story, you can play off of that. You can expand it. You can really make hay out of a very small thing. You can bog someone down in stupid shit, in almost nearly invented scandals, if it is playing off of something that already exists within the minds of the electorate. You can't just incept this person is crooked. If voters know someone and they've decided that person isn't, there's very little you can do to change that. And I think that's what we're about to see in the gubernatorial race in New Mexico.
We will certainly see in
New Jersey. But the other thing is, New Jersey may be like, yeah, so what? Like, this is one of the fun things about New Jersey, is that it's entirely possible they'll be like, yeah, that guy's absolutely bent. Who gives a shit? What's it to you? Fuck you.
But he cut enough shady deals with so many people that they're going to be like, yeah, I made money on that. That's great.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, it's fine. It's the way things are done. Oh, man, this is one of the, I mean, I just, oh, God, it's such a different place. I want to talk a little bit about Congress, and then I'll shut up about the land of enchantment for a little bit here. But New Mexico Congressional District 1 was a really interesting and an unexpectedly interesting primary race this time. It was written up in a couple of national publications because of the strange turn it took. It was fairly quiet. It has gone from being a swing district to being a reliably blue district. Republicans are not really seriously contesting it this time around. It's a huge retention opportunity. It's Michelle Lujan Grisham, gubernatorial candidate that I was just talking about, is the incumbent Democrat. The field narrowed pretty quickly to three. Deborah Holland, who had been the chair of the Democratic Party of New Mexico fairly recently, political campaigner, the would be potentially the first Native woman to be elected to Congress. She's from Laguna Pueblo, if memory serves. And Antoine Cecilia Lopez, who is a retired UNM professor, and the favorite of, and among others, Michelle Lujan Grisham, and had a constituency within New Mexican politics. And a guy named Damon Martinez, who'd been a U.S. attorney, had tangled with Trump a little bit in that capacity. Was a veteran prosecutor, having trouble really getting much traction. And then neither of them, and the race was fairly static for a while. And then a number of outside groups started spending big money on them, on all three of them, because the race wasn't breaking out, and because it was whoever won the primary, the general consensus was win the general. Outside groups came in, spent an enormous amount of money. The race went from being fairly positive to being fairly ugly. And in the end, it looked like Damon Martinez was likely to win. He had about 25%. And the last poll, I think, had Antoine Cecilia Lopez at 22, Deb Holland at 19. Deb Holland won with 40% of the vote. She won a dominant victory. Damon Martinez finished with 26, Antoine Cecilia Lopez with 22. There were, I think, three or four other candidates on the field. They did, one of whom actually had dropped out, but he dropped out so late his name was still on the ballot. Anyway, they sort of rounded out the field. But it revealed a couple of interesting things. First, that showed the extent to which this bluing district has gone left. Deb and Antoinette Cecilia Lopez were competing to be the leftiest, I think, of the candidates. Deb was able to prevail. It shows the power, the interest that Democratic voters have, I think, in electing women and good women candidates this time around. I think there is a sense that Antoine Cecilia Lopez and Deb Holland were drawing from each other's pool. If one of them hadn't won, sometimes when you have a candidate and a second and third place finisher who are close to each other, you get the feeling that if the third place finisher hadn't run, the second place finisher might have done better. That's not what would have happened. If Antoine Cecilia Lopez hadn't been running in New Mexico Congressional District 1, Deb Holland would have won by more. Which is to say, like, they were just like, the electorate was just going to elect a progressive, was going to elect a really good progressive woman this time around. And they did, in Deb Holland. As you can tell, I'm personally very excited about her election. She's great. But one of the things that I thought was interesting as well, Martinez ran, he's a good guy. I'm not throwing stones at Damon Martinez. He ran as a very sort of classic, as centrist as you can get, when the Democratic Party now in a blue district. And then we saw what that was. And, outside groups, he had a lot of money. Outside groups spent a lot of money on him, including a PAC that was set up by, a super PAC that was set up by some folks that Ellie and I know called With Honor, which promotes veterans of both parties. They did a big media buy on his behalf. And that actually began the fact that they were bipartisan, that they were nonpartisan, that they take money from Republicans and Democrats and work with Democrats and Republicans actually became kind of a campaign issue. It was an attack line that other outside groups used used against With Honor and used against Martinez. You know, this guy is supported by people who take money from Trump supporters. So it was not a good, it was a good example of the way a district in 12 years, in 2006, that race was an absolute gunfight of a district, and the Democrat for whom I worked lost by a tenth of a percentage point. Now it is deep, deep blue. These things happen fast. And also, and this is my last point, in this district, we've seen this elsewhere all over the map this cycle. Polls have, and this is, I'm not about to take shot at polling generally. This is endemic, I think, to primary polling. Polls tend to underestimate the winner a little bit. You know, we saw in Texas a number of folks who won their races. The polls had them up by 2 or 3 or 4 points. They won by 10. You know, we saw that, and we've seen that in, and we saw that in New Mexico. Michelle Lujan Grisham at 55 wins with 66. We have Deb Haaland with 19 or 20 or 21 wins with 40. So, you know, the electorate, there is some enthusiasm out there that is just not being caught by these primary polls. It's very hard to catch enthusiasm in primary polls, but basically what we're seeing is Dems are turning out in larger numbers and with greater enthusiasm than the polls are showing. I would be surprised if that does not continue into the general.
All right, that's good guidance. And since the place that I'm currently recording in is about to get super loud, I think we're going to call this episode a little bit short. We've got some really big announcements coming up in the very near future that we're very, very excited about. So please be sure to subscribe and rate us so you can get all that good information. And obviously follow us on Twitter at @takingship, and that's ship with a P as in Philadelphia, Eagles. Please also visit the website, takingship.com. Order yourself a few t-shirts. You know, it's like whiskey that way. How many do you want and in what size? They are a lovely shade of green that is not entirely Notre Dame green.
Hell yeah, hook 'em.
All right, with that, Frank, where are we headed this week?
We are headed, appropriately, to the Lone Star State, the great state of Texas, where I am sorry to say treason season has started early in this particular round of the war on the sea. My friends, I regret to inform you, and it shames me to know that the thing that this is happening in the Lone Star State, a state for which I have, as you can tell, a great deal of affection, that there is a what appears to be a water park that is doing a showing of Jaws, so you can sit there bobbing in an inner tube and watch Jaws. This was also done by Alamo Drafthouse last year. So for two times running, we're having people, presumably decent, God-fearing Americans, inviting other people into the water to watch a film about America, about the world's, not America, but the world's greatest aquatic killing machine. If that is not giving comfort and succor to the enemy, I don't know what the hell is. And so it is time for us to go down there. It's not too late to stamp out this outbreak of treachery. So we at Taking Ship are taking ship via a series of rivers to go down and give these people what for. We watch films about land animals killing us all. We watch this happening on land. We are terrestrial people. You know, it's the land. I guess love it or leave it, or something. My friends, we take ship now for Texas. Okay.
Take care, everybody.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.